University of Wisconsin Law School class. Would they stand, please? Good to have you. You may be seated. I'll call our case 09-AP-728, Wisconsin Medical Society versus Michael L. Morgan, representing the Wisconsin Medical Society, and Dr. Hoffman is Thomas Piper. You may proceed, counsel. You have 25 minutes, according to my schedule. Mr. Weiss will have 10, Ms. Gibson 30, and then you will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Okay?
Thank you, Chief Justice Abramson, and may it please the court and counsel. The Injured Patients and Families Compensation Fund was created to be a mechanism for providers, healthcare providers in Wisconsin, to pool their money so that they could obtain excess medical malpractice insurance through their pooled money. It was not designed to be a revenue-raising tool for the state. By pooling their money, insurance providers would get the benefit of their money and the investment returns on their money so as to obtain lower cost health insurance. That would result in lower health care costs as well as guaranteeing payments to proper medical malpractice claimants. But it only works if the money and the investments on the money remain in the fund, and any surplus that might develop through excess actuarial forecasts are returned to the providers through reduced contribution levels. Otherwise, the fund is returned into a private for-profit fund because the insurance company will take the benefit of all investments. The insurance company will project more money than is needed to pay claims and take that as their profit margin. If the state is allowed to do that, then the goal of having reduced health care costs has been thwarted. As well as, if the state can take the money out of the fund, then the goal of making sure there's adequate money to pay health insurance has likewise been thwarted. So the providers agreed, that's the language in 655-00061A, to participate in the fund, but in return for guarantees that they would be protected. And those guarantees are now under the language of 655-27-6 that the monies in the fund will indeed be used only for medical malpractice.
Counsel, did you just indicate that the providers agree to participate in the fund?
I did.
What happens if they don't?
If they don't, well, it is a mandatory fund in which they must participate. If they do not pay the fund assessments, then they are subject to having their license to practice law in the state revoked.
You don't mean practice law.
UPL hearings are in a few weeks.
I stand corrected. So the consideration that they got for participating in the fund was that the monies would be protected for medical malpractice insurance. The fund will be used for no other state purpose, and the full net worth of the fund will be held in irrevocable trust for the sole benefit of providers and health care claimants.
Suppose the legislature decided that they want a different procedure for handling Med-Mal, and they just stop the fund. What happens to the money?
And the trial court asked the same question. We had a difference of agreement or a difference of opinion. Under the prevailing law, when a trust is set up and then it is revoked, the monies in the fund go for the purposes for which the trust was set up, which here would be to pay claims. If there were any surplus that was left over, it can be returned to the people who contributed the money to the fund.
That's not in the statute.
It is not in the statute.
So you're making it up under trust law.
I am citing trust law, yes.
Okay. And this is not the usual kind of trust.
It is not. It is a public trust.
All right. Suppose instead of doing this, the legislature just said health care providers, there's how much money is there a surplus? How much money is there when this legislation was passed? $700 million?
Approximately $700 million.
There's $700 million in this kitty, and over the whole lifespan of the fund, we've paid out how much? $300 million?
$600 million.
Yeah. Okay. So over 30 years, $600 million. We got 700 in, and, you know, we're not going to pay that out next year. So, or even in maybe 5 years, maybe. So you don't have to contribute to the fund this year. Just pay it to the state.
Pay the money to the state?
You got to pay anyway. So this year, pay it to us. Next year, pay it to the fund. It's sort of the opposite of the, as I see it, of the case we had with the police association, where, in effect, they said, well, you don't have to make contributions. You're a little short, counties. You're a little short, cities. You don't have to make contributions to the pension fund, right?
That is what they call it, the $200 million holiday, Your Honor.
That's right. So I'm going to give the fund a $200 million holiday, but not totally. Just give the money somewhere else. It's a half a holiday.
Well, I would expect that if the fund were, if the result was based on actuarial forecasts that the these providers need no longer contribute to the fund, but there was a diversion of the money to GPR, it would be much more like the Wisconsin teachers case, which exactly happened there, where the fund said, you will fund the special investment performance dividend rather than us taking out of the fund, and this court said that was a deprivation of property rights. If, in fact, there was simply some type of tax that was leveled directly on providers solely to be used for general purpose revenues, then my expectation is there would be a dispute about that.
But a different kind of dispute than in this case.
A different kind of dispute, yes.
So my understanding of the act was that there was $100 million that was set aside that could be drawn upon, if necessary, to keep the fund vibrant, if you will. My understanding under the statute is that assessments can be increased against health care providers. If necessary. Has that happened in either instance? Is there any attempt to get the $100 million? Is there any attempt at this point to increase the assessments to health care providers?
Justice Crooks, taking the first part about it, it's called an assessment, a sum sufficient appropriation, excuse me, and it's under 20.145.2A. And it was for $100 million. And the statute reads that should there ever come a time where there is not sufficient monies to pay to for claims, then at that time there would be this sum sufficient appropriation for $100 million. The fund is done on an accrual basis. In the past, the board has adopted a zero surplus policy so that it's been taking in less money than it is being paid out so that the surplus could be returned to the providers through lower contributions. But there is enough money on an annual basis to pay ongoing claims until you get near the end because of the forecasted period. So it isn't time for that $100 million, but it's our position that that $100 million is illusory for three reasons. One, it is an appropriation. That is an appropriation that stands for each fiscal year. If it is not reappropriated, it's gone. Second, if by simply using the word notwithstanding in front of 655.27.6, which has all the restricted uses on the money, the state can bypass and nonetheless take money out of the fund for a non-trust purpose, what would stop the state from simply saying, notwithstanding the sum sufficient appropriation, we're going to use that money for something else? It can't be counted on. The third reason it is illusory is because the board has a fiduciary duty that it owes to the fund board. Right now we are in a situation where there was a projected, within the next 5 years, $400 million deficit in the fund. The Legislative Audit Bureau just within the last month said within 2 years we are already at a $100 million deficit point. The board cannot let that deficit stand. The board has to protect the security and integrity of the fund. So, in consequence, the board is going to make sure that contribution levels go up to erode the deficit. Once that happens, what would be the call on the $100 million? Because there is no longer a deficit because it has to have been funded by increased contribution levels by the providers. So while the state says that we will do a sum sufficient appropriation if it's ever necessary, one, the likelihood of it being necessary is virtually none because of increased contribution levels. But if this case is allowed to stand, not only could the state take the money out of the fund and leave providers with no excess malpractice coverage, they could simply use the word notwithstanding and vitiate the $100 million appropriation.
Let me take that a little bit further. I looked at the balance sheets that were provided, and as I looked at those balance sheets, what I saw was that there was a deficit net worth. And one of the major components making up that deficit net worth in terms of asset value was called unreported losses. I think that was a major part of it. Can you just explain to me what that means, the unreported losses?
I can explain it in layperson terms as best I can.
That's the best way for me to understand it.
When the actuary does its forecast, it forecasts not only the level of claims that are in the house, so that the checks for those have to be made. It forecasts, based on historical performance, the level of future claims that are foreseeable to a reasonable degree of actuarial certainty. That is what that category is. In other words, in the actuary's opinion, those checks have already been written for the amount of money that is in that fund, and there really is no surplus. Now, there is a dispute over whether there is a surplus or not, but it is our position is that dispute really, unless this court were to find that the only property interest was in making sure there was coverage there, then that dispute, we submit, would require a remand for a trial on whether there was a deficit or not. But it's our position is it really is irrelevant because the surplus is not the state's surplus. The surplus is there because the language says the full net worth of the fund is to be held in the fund solely for these beneficiaries and for no other state purpose. So it's our position that all the money is earmarked for existing claims and projected unreported claims based on what actuaries do.
And as I understand your position, we don't have to determine to decide this case whether or not indeed there is a negative net worth to the assets of the fund. Is that correct?
You do not need to decide that, Your Honor. Our position is that it wouldn't matter, but if, I mean, the dispute really comes down to what the trial court said, at least implicitly, is there is a property interest of providers in making sure that there is sufficient insurance. We submit he ignored the language in the statute that says the full net worth is there for providers and beneficiaries. But if this court were to agree that only the level necessary to pay claims was there, you wouldn't have to decide whether there was a deficit. But that is a disputed fact, and it was disputed in front of the trial court. the state and the society and Dr. Hoffman entered into a stipulation, which is in part of the record, that said that's a disputed issue. So while you would not have to decide whether it in fact exists, we would submit it would be cause for remand for a trial on that issue.
Do you think it's a genuine issue of material fact if we don't have to decide it?
Well, I don't know that the purpose here is for the evidence of deciding that issue in front of your honor, because it would be a battle of the actuaries. But I don't believe it's a disputed issue of fact, because the Independent Legislative Audit Bureau already came up and said within 2 years we're already at a $209 million deficit. They have no axe to grind in this case. They're not aligned with either side.
Thank you.
Could I inquire exactly what went down in October 2007 and the following year? What the legislation has passed takes effect, I think, on the 26th of October 2007.
Yes, sir.
And then what happened?
The lawsuit was started on October 26th.
Well, no, I mean what happened in the fund.
Oh, well, in the fund, the first 70, I can't remember the exact amount, but 72 to 75 million was withdrawn immediately. And the next 125, if we assume 75, was withdrawn at the next fiscal year. Oh. In the fund, the board then met, and I believe this is in the minutes that are part of the record, and the issue was whether contribution rates should be increased immediately to take into consideration the withdrawal of the money. I don't represent the fund, but it's my understanding that that was decided.
Let me follow up here. This is the fund. This is medical assistance. Did they send $71.5 million directly from the fund over here?
I'm sorry, I misunderstood you. They attempted to take it all out of the fund and move it to the Medical Assistance Trust, the Department of Administration. And that's why Secretary Morgan is a named party. There was not enough liquid assets in the fund to do that. So they borrowed money from other funds.
Who is they?
I believe it's the Department of Administration. And took the money from those funds and put it into the Medical Assistance Trust Fund so as to make up the incremental difference, and then started charging the trust, the fund, interest on the money it had withdrawn from other funds to put into the Medical Assistance Trust Fund to make up the difference, because there was not sufficient liquid funds in the Injured Patients and Family Compensation Fund to transfer.
So are you saying that the borrower from other funds is the Secretary of Administration?
I know that his department was the department that instituted the mechanics of what happened. I don't know if it would be he that is the borrower. My expectation is it is the state that is the borrower, but yes. They borrowed from other funds to make up the difference of what was not available.
Okay. Let me ask this. All $200 million has been taken out of the fund. Is that right?
I believe so. I don't know if there is still not enough liquid assets from the investments are with SWIB, and whether those have all been liquidated as we sit here today, so it has all gone in, I'm not sure. We put into the record the last report we had received from the Department of Administration saying that the accrual of interest from borrowed funds was still being charged against the fund. But one way or another, the $200 million is over there.
Well, I think I will ask the Assistant Attorney General what authority there is in the legislation to charge any interest to the fund. I mean, you have this section at the back of Act 20 that says they can take the money, where does it say they can take any interest?
Well,
you're on
I
deck.
Just don't know
you're
if
on deck. I have a question for you. I assume that the reason that we've got such a drop in the asset value is because of the market.
I assume that as well.
And $700 million, which should have been enough to cover, theoretically, $600 million of claims over 30 years, has dropped significantly because of the market.
I spoke too soon. I don't know if I can make the assumption of how much was strictly because of the raid. And the reason is because the actuary immediately following the raid projected out a $400 million deficit over 5 years. I am certain that the actuary took into consideration forecasting market
conditions. But they're not going to pay out $400 million over 5 years.
Pardon me?
Is that what they're going to pay out in five?
No.
It's what claims might be made, but they'll be paid out over a much longer term.
Yes. But that is the danger of looking at whether a surplus exists in a snapshot in time. Because
how much has the fund been charged in interest since the transfer?
I'm sorry, sir, I didn't hear you.
How much has the fund been charged in interest since the transfer?
I can't answer that, Your Honor. It's not in the record. I'm not aware of that. All I know is what was in the public records that we put into the record, that there was continuing accrual of interest based upon these charges.
You're objecting to the whole takeover. You're not objecting merely to the interest.
No, I'm not.
You haven't briefed whether the interest is legal or not.
Oh, we have not. We are asking for the full $200 million plus interest based on the Wisconsin Teachers Association case. But that's an important category of the contract impairment issue, because one of the issues that the court said was that sovereign immunity barred all the other claims other than the property taking. And that is not correct when the purpose of the injunctive and declaratory judgment relief is to stop a continuing harm, even if it might have an ancillary effect on the state treasury. There is continuing harm here, because as long as that $200 million is not in the fund, it's losing interest every day. And that interest is, by statute, a fund asset.
So you're also asking, are you not, for actual attorney's fees?
We are asking for actual attorney's fees. That issue was not raised, both under the common fund theory that this court adopted in the Wisconsin Teachers case and under Section 1983.
You get attorney fees, is that then fit the purpose of the statute, which is to protect the doctors and the claimants?
Well, that,
because this is not a class action.
No, but that is the purpose for the common fund theory. When a common fund has been returned to the benefit of all participants, that the fund that has been returned can be appropriately charged for the interest fees. But we also are seeking fees under 1983 that would be divorced from the fund, that would be a strict state payment. But those issues have not yet been resolved.
So it has to go back for those. If the court would hold for you, these issues have to go back?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Given the presumption that attaches to legislation, presumption of constitutionality, what is it about the legislation that makes it unconstitutional beyond a reasonable doubt?
Well, it takes private money and uses it for a non-state or for a state purpose here when it's earmarked for trust purposes without just compensation. And it is also an impairment of the contract rights of the providers with the fund. In Lightborn, this court said that there was not simply a contract link between property interests or property rights, but instead that the purpose clause itself provided independent property rights in the fund to make sure when the purpose is for restricted use, as the ETF fund is, as is the Injured Patients and Families Compensation Fund, that that purpose clause was an independent property right that the beneficiaries of the fund had the right to enforce. The court also said that the property interest in the security and integrity of the fund as a whole, staying within the management of the board, was an independent property right totally divorced from contract. There cannot be any dispute that those property interests have been taken. And the only way that those property interests can be returned is if the money is indeed returned to the fund.
Chief, may I ask a question?
I'm sorry.
Your red light is on, but I have a question to ask. You assert several protected property interests. Which one is your best argument?
Boy, they're all three so good.
Oh,
it's hard
I know. Good answer. Try.
If I were to rank them, I believe that the providers and the injured patients' ultimate property interest is to protect the security and integrity of this fund. It's there for medical malpractice for no other reasons. It's made up of private contributions. It isn't the type of transportation fund that the trial court analogized, which is paid by fees, and those fees go to an acknowledged state purpose. This isn't a state purpose. It is for private insurance. Next in order, I would say the purpose of the fund. The purpose of this fund was that restricted use for pooling providers' monies instead of going into the commercial market so that they could have lower cost insurance, because that would inure to the benefit of patients through lower health care costs, at the same time ensuring there'd be malpractice coverage there. And my third in order would be the contract rights that we assert that providers have with the fund. Those are the three interests that this court identified as separate property rights in the Lightborn case.
Thank you. Mr. Wise, you represent AMICUS, Wisconsin Association for Justice.
May it please the court and counsel, I'm Jim Weiss, and I'm here on behalf of the Wisconsin Association of Justice. And we appreciate the court's opportunity in order to file an amicus in this case. We certainly appreciate as well the opportunity to orally argue the case. I guess I'd like to simply start out by saying the obvious, and that is that both Article 1, Section 12 and Article 1, Section 13, one prohibits the taking of property, the other prohibits the impairment of contract. And while it's an unusual circumstance for me to stand before this podium and agree with the doctors and the fund on any proposition, I have to agree with them strongly on both of those propositions. And I guess what I'd like to do today in the brief time that I have is share with the court why I think that there's an impairment of a contractual obligation here and why there's a deprivation of property. And let me start with a contract, if I can. And I guess we have to go back to the history of this fund. And I think it's very important and probably hasn't been stated enough by the parties and by amicus in this case, and that is that this trust fund is a very unique and unusual fund. It differs radically from the other kinds of funds that have been dealt with by this court in the past. And let me talk a little bit about how that I think it does, because I think it goes to this issue of both the contractual obligation and the property interest in the fund. Let's contrast it, for instance, to the transportation fund, in which there have been rulings that you can transfer money out of that fund to another fund. The transportation fund is radically different than the medical malpractice fund. I won't go through and recite all of the history of the medical malpractice fund, but think of the distinctions. For instance, the beneficiary under the transportation fund is the infrastructure of the state, which I guess then benefits all taxpayers. There is nothing in the transportation fund to indicate that the sole beneficiaries are the people that buy licenses or the people that will pump gas. The beneficiaries are everyone in the state, and the intent of it is to create infrastructure. When the legislature created this medical malpractice scheme back in the 1970s, and then in 2003, when it was reaffirmed, they made a radical difference from other trusts, and they said that the sole beneficiaries under this trust were going to be the injured claimants along with the healthcare providers, the sole beneficiaries. That makes that trust very, very different, for instance, than the transportation trust or the environmental trust.
Counsel, it is easier for me to understand the language of sole beneficiary with the idea of a trust that there's potential that claimants will get some money, as beneficiaries of trusts hopefully would do. I don't understand the same with regard to the medical society, that there's an anticipation that the doctors will get some money.
Well, I think that actually back at the time that this was formulated, and then in 2003 again when it was reinforced with this additional language, I think that there was definitely the intent of the legislature and the intent of the doctors who entered into this agreement with the legislature that there was going to be a benefit and that the benefit would be reduced malpractice costs to the doctors. And to use simple math, if we had the doctors buying $1 million in coverage and then the doctors buying an excess policy from a private insurer, one of the things that would happen there is that the private insurer would have a profit on that, which potentially would make the premium increased above what they would have to pay to the state fund.
Counsel, you, in response, have turned the phrase a little bit, and that is it would benefit them. But I'm not sure what is meant by the word beneficiary in the statute. Normally, a trust beneficiary gets some money. Another way of using that phrase in a more vernacular sense is, oh, I'm a beneficiary if it benefits me in some way or another. But that's a different meaning. That's a different use of the word beneficiary than we would normally see with regard to a beneficiary of a trust. If my parents had set up a trust for me and I was a beneficiary, I hope it wasn't just a beneficiary of love and wishes for having a happy life. I'd like a little money out of that trust too, you know? And so that's very much a hypothetical. So how are you using that word? Well, beneficiary, what does it mean?
I think that to use an illustration based upon this case is that what happened immediately after the fund was raided is that the doctor's premiums were going to have to go up in order to meet the actuarial needs of the fund. And so there is a clear detriment to them by virtue of this taking that they would benefit from the system.
I'm not sure that's the same as the term of art, beneficiary, vis-a-vis trust law.
But you represent the people that are injured.
I do.
You view them as the beneficiaries.
Well, absolutely, and it's been conceded by the state that the beneficiary or that the claimants, proper claimants, do have a property interest in the fund, which is of interest to me because obviously they contend that the medical society does not have a property interest in the fund, but the claimants, who are also obviously constitutional participants in this situation, They do have a property interest in the fund, and that property interest clearly gets impaired when the fund is at a level where, as the actuaries project now, it can't meet costs over the long term.
We don't even know who they are. They're everybody. They could be everybody in this room and then some. We don't know what's going to happen to us tomorrow.
Well, we do know about some of them because there's $35 million that's held as a part of the medical malpractice fund for individuals that have already been awarded
that's
money.
Not impaired.
Well,
they're okay.
I would argue, certainly if I was an actuary, Justice Abramson, and I came in and I was asked whether this fund was impaired or not, as the actuaries have been, they have concluded that, in fact, it is impaired, and that in order to correct that impairment, additional fees will need to be sought from the doctors to meet that deficit.
Mr. Weiss, I've got another question that's going to take you in a little different route. In the brief of the Wisconsin Association for Justice, the theory is set forth, I think probably for the first time in terms of the briefs I've read on this matter, in regard to a violation of substantive due process. Can you capsulize for me that argument?
Sure. I think that I can. It is not the simplest argument in the world, but I will try to boil it down to its essence. Substantive due process in its inherent nature prohibits the arbitrary exercise of government power. Let me try to boil it down to that simple phrase. And when we look at what happened here, it's obvious to everyone in the room what happened here. There was a shortage of general revenue, and the state went searching for a place in order to get that general revenue. They decided that the fund was sitting there, and it was a pot of money that they could take that money from. So instead of increasing tax revenue, which would have been the appropriate constitutional method for doing that, what they did is they grabbed money out of the fund. And who does that cost? Well, it costs directly the doctors, because the doctors have the obligation under the rules of the fund to keep that at an actuarial zero balance. And they have to make up the difference. And so they get taxed that additional premium, and they get taxed it in an inappropriate way. I think that three-card Monty that the government does, that the legislature did in order to find those funds, is inappropriate. If they did it directly and didn't call it taxation, if they called up the docs or they called up lawyers or they called up any entity and simply said, we're going to assess you money, we're going to assess you $200 million and didn't call it a tax, it would be constitutionally infirm. That's what they've done here. That's what they've done by indirect means. And the fact that they've done it indirectly doesn't change the fact that they still have done it and done it in violation of the Constitution.
Thank you.
Red light is on.
Thank you, Mr. Weiss.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Charlotte Gibson, Attorney Gibson, Assistant Attorney General of the State of Wisconsin, representing Michael Morgan.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. 65527 as a comprehensive system to manage medical malpractice liability in Wisconsin has been very successful and has been of great benefit to the people in the state. And the doctors, too, get many benefits that would be unavailable to them if the program didn't exist and they went out on the market and bought private excess policies. They get absolute statutory immunity from claims even if the fund were insolvent. They get expert staffing by OCI and management of the fund by SWIB. There's a tax-free accumulation of all the monies in the fund, so it's accruing much faster. And the fact that participation is statutorily mandated brings everybody into the pool and brings assessments down even more. But there are downsides of this public mandated program for them as well. They don't have any right to distributions of surplus or of the corpus. Once their assessments are made, they're gone. And they can't prevent the legislature from transferring monies into other state accounts if the legislature decides that that's the wisest public policy. Now, in order to avoid the downside, WMS argues essentially that the fund has become a private fund for its members. But in making that argument, it faces a very steep burden. This court must indulge every presumption that the legislation is constitutional. In order to overcome that, WMS must precisely identify a mandatory right to a concrete benefit, money the providers can freely use and dispose of. And WMS just can't meet that heavy burden where they have no free use of the assessments, no right to distributions of surplus, no right to receive money if the statutory system is ever discontinued. And lots of courts, as we've cited in the brief, have looked at public insurance funds like this one and have used a consistent set of criteria in evaluating whether insureds have private property interests in them. And where, like here, participation is mandatory and there is no right to any distribution or payout, no court has found a property interest. Now, in order to get away from that traditional black law takings analysis, WMS encourage us to go to Lightburn and try to compare themselves to the WRS participants. But the WRS participants' rights in Lightburn were all tied to the very long-established principle, going back to at least Geisel, that public participants have accrued contractual rights by virtue of their employment contracts with the state. And the reason that the statutory rights in Chapter 40 are enforceable property rights for them is because those become part of that contract. They become part of the inducement for the public employees to continue in their employment in public service. Lightburn always ties back those statutory rights to accrued contractual rights. And what this case is really like is if the public employers in Lightburn, the ones that were having the holiday, come out and assert that they had a property right in the WRS, pointing again to those statutes and saying, well, those statutes are freestanding sources of property rights. We don't need any contractual rights. But that Lightburn is clear, I don't think it was trying to make some kind of leap from the classic public pension participants law. Now, we know that these people, the WMS's members, don't have contractual rights. First of all, it's not a voluntary program. It's a mandatory program, which council concedes today. 655-006, which was focused on by some of the non-party briefs, is not a contract between the doctors and the state. It's entitled remedy. I think in the original 75 legislation it was actually called exclusive remedy. And it's a statement that the only remedies for patients and doctors, both of them, are in this statute. And this court will probably recall that in Strakowski, the patients brought some challenges to the alternative dispute resolution provisions in 655-27. They didn't like them as much as going right to a court. And this provision gets to that idea, well, you can only go, you have to use that chapter. And this court said that in Rouse. Second, even if it were voluntary, which of course it's not, the statutes don't provide for any mandatory right to distribution. And to have a property right, it has to be mandatory. You can go back to the certified question case out of Michigan where they had a discretionary right to distribution and what was actually a voluntary fund. And the Michigan Supreme Court said, that's not enough. It can't be a contractual right if it's up to the discretion of somebody else. But here, of course, they have no rights to distribution at all. And third, the legislature rejected giving the providers and claimants those rights when 2003 Act 11 was being considered. As you saw, the legislation had that kind of language in it, and at the urging of the trial lawyers, it was removed.
May I ask you a question? Please give me the facts of what happened in October 2007.
So the money was transferred in two chunks. And basically,
who transferred what?
So DOA just has bookkeeping, and all they did was transfer money on the books. I mean, it's all in one pot. It's not like they had to call up Anchor Bank and get the money. And then this issue with the interest, there certainly was enough money in the fund to pay the whole amount of that transfer at that time. But
there was?
Yeah. But SWIB's investment portfolio has investments with higher liquidity and more long-term investments that if you liquidate them, you're going to maybe pay a penalty or lose the opportunity to participate in an investment that has a very high earnings potential. So I believe the Board of Governors and SWIB together decided that it made more sense financially for the fund to ask to borrow from other funds rather than to liquidate assets and just pay it then.
So you're saying that the injured patients fund borrowed money?
Yes.
From whom?
From other state accounts.
And did they have to pay interest on that?
Yes, and that's just a standard. Apparently, state accounts are borrowing from each other all the time.
What is the statutory authority for them to pay interest?
I'm sorry, I don't know that offhand, but if you'd like me to send you a letter and give you the citation, I can.
Well, this whole thing is dependent on that section at the end of Act 20 that authorizes this transfer. I don't think there's anything in that section that authorizes the taking of interest.
Well, I mean, if you want to read it that narrowly, let's assume just for the moment that there is a statute that permits inter-account borrowing among state funds. Because it's done so commonly, I'm hopeful there is such authority. The statute required this 2020 required the whole amount, the whole first chunk of it, to be transferred immediately. So if you want to read it strictly, really, SWIB should have liquidated whatever assets were necessary so that the whole amount would have been paid in full at that time. But I think the option for these state funds to do some inter-fund borrowing when it makes more sense for their investments, it seems like a much wiser way to manage the state's money than requiring that kind of liquidating.
So the perfectly lawful way to do this would have been to force the fund to liquidate assets to accommodate this transfer. Is that right? Then they wouldn't have had to pay interest.
I guess I'm hesitating to characterize it as perfectly lawful, because if interfund borrowing is legal, then it would be perfectly lawful to do either way.
You certainly are not arguing, are you, that the state could use any source of authority to take money from the injured patient's compensation fund other than the authority at the end of Chapter 20? What is it?
No.
9225 or something like that section. Isn't that the only source of authority to do that?
Yes. Well, because the borrowing wasn't mandated by the legislature, right? The borrowing was done upon a decision of the Board of Governors.
But it was forced by the legislature.
No. The money was in the fund. It was just in long-term investments that it made more sense financially to pay the – I've forgotten the exact interest rate, but it's pretty low. So financially speaking, it made more sense to have some relatively short-term borrowing by that account against other state accounts rather than liquidate long-term investments and incur penalties and loss of investment opportunity. But it wasn't mandated.
In your opening statement, you gave the rationale for this legislation. Other than the state pension funds, is there any fund in the state that this rationale wouldn't apply to?
I'm sorry, which rationale do you mean?
Well, your explanation for the legislation that you gave in your opening statement.
You mean the comprehensive way to manage medical malpractice in our state?
Well, you talked about there not being a certain property right payable out, and that all the factors that you outline. Is there any fund in the state that could not be rated this way by the legislature?
In terms of a takings analysis, there are a couple of funds that come to mind right away. One of them is 61904, which is optional medical malpractice insurance that doctors can buy for liability up to $1 million. And that statute provides for mandatory rights of either return or lower premiums. Another state program that would apply would be the State Life Insurance Fund, which I think is in Chapter 607, which any of us can choose to buy a policy under, again, in lieu of private life insurance. It's a small policy. And there are provisions that require earnings on that fund to be returned to the policyholders.
Oh, this court assessed attorneys a $50 assessment a few years ago to help people with civil litigation needs. Could the legislatures take that money?
I think so, Your Honor. I mean, you have to look at the statutory terms, right? I mean, if somebody has a mandatory right to receive some money out of earnings or something, I'm just not aware of that in that program.
Okay, and all the funds that are to help those people who've been injured by the malpractice, but unethical behavior of attorneys, the legislature can just take that money?
I mean, without reading the entire statute, I can't promise that, but my assumption would be yes.
And isn't that the precedent that we're talking about here today?
Yes, and it's to the extent it's a program that you're enthusiastic about, having the legislature transfer monies out of it to some program you're less enthusiastic about doesn't feel great. But the question for when we get to interfere with those policy choices is very narrow. We can interfere judicially only if there's a private property interest, and that's very rarely the case. Now, the alternative is to tie up the legislature for all time by allowing legislatures to just put magic language in statutes like never transfer money again or irrevocable, and then we're left with the horse and buggy fund in the year 2200 because the legislature back in 1900 thought it was such an awesome idea, and maybe it was then.
And that $100 million that was appropriate, that's sort of magic language too, isn't it?
No, it's not. I mean, then all appropriations in
was
Chapter 21.
Was one penny actually appropriated to the Office of the Commissioner of Insurance?
Well, one immediate effect of it is that the board is required to consider that $100 million as part of the assets in the fund when it does fee setting. So that's an immediate impact of it. Now, I think the most likely scenario you would have for when it would actually get used is if the legislature moved to a different system and left this one in place for claims that it accrued for some period of time. And eventually, the funds would be drawn down. And then the people who filed the claim could file a claim against that appropriation specifically.
Is that $100 million more actuarially sound than the projections of the actuaries for all the draws on the fund in the future?
I'm sorry, I don't understand the question.
Well, it would seem to me the legislature could just simply repeal that language. Just like that.
Well, I mean,
because you're saying words like irrevocable are meaningless. They can just be changed, and they can be, you can have something that is notwithstanding, but they can just be repealed. You cannot bind a future legislature. That's your position.
That's right, and that's the constitutional idea of the right of legislatures to make different choices about the allocation and reallocation of scarce resources.
Ms. Gibson, one of the things I wanted to ask you about has to do with the Tuttle case, which comes out of the state of New Hampshire. Both you and opposing counsel called the court's attention to that case. It's my understanding that in a somewhat similar situation, and I'm not suggesting it's on all fours, but in a somewhat similar situation, the New Hampshire Supreme Court arrived at a conclusion that when the legislature in New Hampshire attempted to do this, that it violated their constitution on the basis of a theory of impairment of contract rights. What do you say in regard to the applicability, if any, of the Tuttle case on this situation? Because we're talking in both instances about a patient's compensation fund.
Right. Well, actually, the Tuttle case wasn't a patient's compensation fund. It was an optional Med-Mal liability insurance program that people could choose to buy into or not. And that's the same type of program as we have in 61904, and which I think the state couldn't transfer money out of.
So you but think the fund is very different than the fund that's at issue here?
Right. And the reason that the facts in Tuttle are distinguishable, and this is consistent with all these cases we've cited from other state Supreme Courts, is because in Tuttle, first of all, it's voluntary. Second, when people get their policy, they actually get a contract from this Joint Underwriters Association in Tuttle. It promises them you will either receive, as a mandatory matter, distributions of surplus or a future reduction in premium. It's explicit, it's mandatory. And they distinguish the NRA certified question case out of Michigan, which we pointed to, saying, well, the reason those folks didn't have a property right was because they had only a discretionary right to distributions. Here, there's a mandatory one. So again, at the end of the day in Tuttle, the people who chose to buy that policy had a real life right to some actual cash in hand. It was an actual explicit mandatory right to some money. And I think Tuttle's totally consistent with all the other, I think, state law cases on this. So if we can just get back to the, I think the contract issue is really clear, and if we can just get back to the notion that this is a private trust. They give us a lot of cases on private trust, but there is no case suggesting that the legislature's creation of a public trust fund conveys property rights to the class of people benefiting from that program. And even the statement in 4001-2 that the WRS funds are a public trust, it doesn't convey property to the WRS participants. It just tells them that money that we all accept is theirs is going to be managed in trust. And that's the difference between managing money in a particular way and actually conveying property. And there's no case that I'm aware of where a state trust fund has been interpreted as actually conveying property rights in people arguably benefiting from the program. And in fact, the two courts that have addressed that question directly, In Re Certified Question and Eccles, have both said calling a fund a trust fund doesn't create any property rights. And if there were any analogy at all to a non-state public trust, it would be to a charitable trust. And in a charitable trust, a class benefiting from the terms of that trust has no vested property rights in it. In fact, the class members don't even have standing to enforce the terms of the trust. So if it's for the, you know, education of children of Irish immigrants, and somebody looks at how the trustee's running it and says, oh, actually, it's Serbian children, they have no standing to challenge the use of those trust monies. So
certainly a fund for Irish immigrants' children has to be protected.
At least today.
We'll deal with that case next term.
Can I interrupt you for a minute? The thing we haven't touched upon is sovereign immunity. And my understanding of the state's position is that that really takes care of most of the claims being brought by the other side here. Do you want to briefly explain to us your position in regard to sovereign immunity?
Well, all of the money has been transferred. It's gone. And so requiring the money to be put in there would require the legislature to convene and come up with a bill and raise taxes. So obviously this would be a judgment that would fix the state's liability from monetary debt. It doesn't have to be damages that are paid over. It just has to fix the state's monetary liability. So that gets rid of your whole injunctive exception. And so then the question is whether claims for damages under their various causes of action have been considered barred by sovereign immunity, and except for takings, which is a self-executing waiver of the state's immunity under the Constitution, both federally and state, all the causes of action would be barred.
Now, as to this interest of the court in interest, the fund had the use of the money that it didn't pay over. So one assumes that that was a value.
Certainly. No, that money would have had earnings just like anything else. The next thing I want to touch upon is the idea that the 2003 Act 11 had some kind of effect on property rights or contract rights in this fund. And just because the WMS in its response to the non-party brief of the Advocates for Public Health had said that the statute leading up to the 2003 change also spoke of a benefit in terms of specific groups. And I just want to emphasize to the court that wasn't the case, that the statute in place, say in 2002, just said the fund shall be held in trust for the purposes of this chapter. Now, our position is that change didn't work any magic, but to the extent it did, the balance in the fund in 2003 was, I don't know, $700 million. And certainly the $200 million could have been taken from amounts that weren't in trust until this magic language. But then getting back to the magic language idea, we've dealt with the issue that trust funds don't create property rights. They don't convey property to anybody. So they're left with this idea that the word irrevocable has some kind of magical effect. And it doesn't, irrevocable doesn't say anything to me about property. It just seems to connote permanency. And the drafter at LRB told the people who wanted this change, including the Medical Society, that, you know, this word irrevocable isn't going to commit future legislatures. It can't constitutionally. And that's exactly what the Colorado Supreme Court held unanimously in Barber, was that the state can't create an irrevocable public trust because it violates that basic constitutional legislative prerogative. And again, we don't want state programs to be cemented for perpetuity because, if first you're stuck with these, you know, antiquated purposes that you don't want anymore, and then it denies the voters an opportunity to say no to programs they don't like. I mean, the best fix for a legislature doing something you hate is to retire the legislators who are making the decisions you disagree with. So,
could I ask, how much money is still left in the trust fund?
Well, the LAB report used a June 09 number of about $650 million.
How much could the legislature take?
Well, money is fungible. So I think, you know, in theory, they could transfer the amount somewhere else. But the question is, to what legal obligations would they have to pay claimants who came along? And I think the medical expense account holders who have those segregated accounts that are accounted for and sitting there and earning interest, I think those people would have to be compensated. And I think there may be legal obligations of the state to pay for other kinds of claims that come along too. All we're talking, I'm sorry.
Well, other than those isolated funds, accounts that you talk about, could the legislature take it all and then maybe honor its commitments on a like a self-insured basis?
Sure.
Okay.
Counsel, what import is it in your argument and analysis that you acknowledge there's a property interest with regard to injured victims, but not acknowledge a property interest with regard to the medical society?
Okay, well, I should say first, they're not a party, and we just started thinking about this. So, you know, basically we're making sort of an initial guess about it. But the extent to which any patients have rights in the fund, first of all, is limited to the amount of a claim and doesn't arise until they actually make a claim. So this is like the Fazio case where Mrs. Fazio didn't have any vested property right until she actually filed a claim for the death benefit. So for the medical expense account holders, they've actually gotten a judgment or settlement, filed a claim, paid over money that didn't even belong to the fund. It belonged to the MedMal insurer for under $1 million. And the fund is holding it there for them to pay out potential claims. So it seems like their source of property right doesn't come from 655-27-6. It comes from that series of events. And there may be other claimants who have some kind of property rights flowing from the facts of their experience, but again, it's not from that statutory clause. And the rights of the medical expense account holders aren't in the whole corpus and interest of the fund. We know exactly what the maximum right they have is. Now, I think, you know, there's a case out of Louisiana, I'm not going to have the site right now, that said these medical expense accounts, you don't have any property right into them until you actually have a medical expense. So you actually show up and say, oh, look, here I have this medical need, now I need the money. So that's an even more conservative approach to it. So, but those are the people whose experiences with the fund have made them had a judgment, filed a claim, had it accepted, and the money is segregated.
Is it arguable? It's certainly arguable. What's your position as to whether or not the transfer constitutes a unconstitutional taking of a property right vis-a-vis the injured victims?
Well, we think there is no, for that one little group that we think there's probably a vested property right in, there's no taking because their money's sitting there in the segregated account. Just
that's the 619-04 group.
No, that's 655-015.
Okay.
61904 is a whole different pot of money. For everyone else, they don't have any vested property rights yet because they haven't filed a claim. They haven't gotten a judgment and filed a claim, to my knowledge. I mean, maybe there are people out there that are sitting and waiting for their claim. But then even once they file the claim and establish that vested right to get the money, there's just, right now there's $655 million. The claim is going to be honored. I think we all accept that. The question is, if someday down the line such a person came along and filed a claim, whether, you know, the failure of the state to pay it at that point would constitute a taking. And I think it's possible that the state would have to compensate that on a self-insured basis. I just don't know. Okay, I just wanted to make two more comments on the other sources of property rights. I see my yellow light is on. WMS argues that the composition of the fund alone creates a property right. There's no case law supporting that, and indeed some of the trust funds, such as the Universal Service Fund under 2595, are funded solely through a single provider group. So there's no case law supporting the idea that if you get the funds from one source versus many sources, that creates a property right. And then the statement of statutory purpose, we can leaf through the statutes here for a long time, and the legislature typically talks about all these great purposes that we believe very strongly in and when it enacts different policies, and none of those statements of purpose have been construed as creating a property right. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Questions? Thank you, Ms. Gibson. Mr. Piper.
Thank you, Your Honor. Justice Prosser, I'd like to respond to your question and answer. You asked whether the legislature could take all of the money in the fund, and I believe the response was, well, they would still have obligations under segregated accounts. 619.04 sub 9 expressly says that if the fund is insolvent, there is not enough money in the fund, the state will have no liability of any kind to anybody. So under this analysis, the state could take all of the money out of the fund, and the state would have no obligation to pay anybody because there wasn't money in the fund. Justice Bradley, you asked about the definition of beneficiaries and that it isn't money, direct money. When you think of the insurance fund, when there is a claim that is made, it is true that the payment of that money goes to the claimant, but that is on behalf of a debt that the provider owes. The provider owes that money. Whether it would go to the provider first and then go directly to the claimant, I believe, is irrelevant. The money is there for the direct benefit of the providers because they're the ones that owe the debt when there is a valid claim, and that is what is being paid on their behalf. Under the tax code, that would be income to the doctors. The question was asked, I believe, Justice Crooks, about Tuttle. And I think the answer was that it is distinguished, but because it was mandatory in Tuttle. And also, the statement was made, no case has ever said that holding money under trust or under the management of the board is, in fact, a property interest. We submit that that is exactly what Lightborn says. That's the security and interest in the fund. So if the management of the board is a property interest, this board has adopted a zero surplus policy. This board has been taking less contributions in than payments out, so the monies could be returned through lower contributions. That's identical to the Tuttle. In Tuttle, it was statutory. Here, the board is given the discretion to do that, and taking the money out robs the board of that discretion and is a taking of property interest. The certified question case does not say what counsel said. Certified question was that there was a fund that became privatized. In the privatization of that fund, certain persons argued, well, they paid more than this fund is worth, we should get the money. The Michigan Supreme Court said not one dime was taken out of that trust and used for a non-trust purpose. It's all still there, and because of that, there was no taking. The state has cited no case to this court where any money was taken out of a trust, where the trust was set up solely to benefit designated people, which is much different than all of the other Chapter 25 trusts. These are monies of individuals solely to benefit other individuals, and that has been taken out of the trust.
Counsel, help me with this part of the Tuttle case that cites to the certified question case that you just mentioned.
Yes.
And it indicates most significantly the certified question court held, I'm reading from Tuttle, quoting from certified question, absent an explicit expression of the legislature's intention that premiums collected and not used to pay liabilities would be refunded, we cannot read the subject legislative provision as so promising. I don't find any explicit expression of the legislature's intention with regard, let's say, to refund in our statutory enactment. Tuttle seemed to rely on the policy that is issued and the words in the policy, you know, piece of paper. It says right after that, in contrast, the plan before us provides such explicit expression or regulatory expression. So,
well, in terms of,
how do you deal with that?
This legislation, 655.27 sub 6, says that the full net worth is to be held for the beneficiaries. It then explicitly, the legislation explicitly gives to the board the discretion of how to manage that. And if the board in that discretion decides to return it through lower contributions, is that not the same as a legislative intent dictating an outcome? Here it gave that by deferring it to the...
That's part of the question. Is that an explicit enough expression that the money is to be returned?
Well, I believe it is, mm-hmm. because all they're doing is giving broader powers to the fund board for it to determine how the fund is managed. I see my red light is on. I thank you for listening and hearing the case.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Mr. Piper, Mr. Weiss, Ms. Gibson, for your arguments today and this case involving taking and contract law. And so ends our hearing on 09AP728, Wisconsin Medical Society versus Michael L. Morgan. The court will meet in a closed conference at 3:15, and we are in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:45.